All right, so we are continuing our study through the doctrine of the church. And where did we leave off last week? Church government. And what are these on the board here? Types of church government. And of course, they're all kind of secondary, because ultimately, what type of government is the church? A monarchy, that's right. We have a king and a head, the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Now, last week we did cover the Congregationalist model. Does someone want to try to give a summary of the Congregationalist model? What are some of the key things in the Congregationalist form of church government? Okay, yeah, so the vote of the congregation members is really at the heart of where the power is. At the end of the day, they tend to, in the congregationalist model, have the final say on the direction of the church and how the church is ran. Anything else on the congregationalist model? A few different components to it.
Is it independent?
Independent, yeah. We emphasize that part of the congregationalist model is that they are independent. They're not officially connected in a denomination. Now, with the caveat that you do have congregationalist churches that are part of denominations, like the Southern Baptist or Baptists in general tend to be part of conventions, and those conventions do connect them, but not in any sort of real authoritative way. If you go on, say, the Southern Baptist Convention website and read about their way they operate, you realize they emphasize the autonomy of independent local churches, that the churches that are in the convention are there voluntarily, the decisions of the conventions are in no way binding upon them, and really, most of the things that the Southern Baptist Convention or Baptist conventions believe, they don't even necessarily have to be held by the independent local churches who are part of those conventions, though it would be strange to be a part of a group if you didn't hold the things the group held to. So there's an emphasis on the autonomy of each independent congregation. Anything else that you guys remember about congregationalists that we mentioned last week? What maybe we covered the main things, but to maybe to point out that we said that in a congregationalist model, the local church's day-to-day governance sometimes can vary significantly. Some of them are basically like the pastor is the CEO, that he's basically Pope of the church and runs everything until the congregation replaces him. That's often one model. Sometimes you'll find that there is an elder board or a deacon board that really operates and runs the day-to-day operations of the church. Though, again, the congregation holding, generally speaking, the power to replace the pastor or replace the elder board or replace the deacon board. So that's your general congregationalist model. Baptists are congregationalists. Maybe you've heard of congregational churches or congregationalist churches. They would have that same sort of model. And again, it doesn't mean that those churches don't ever have conventions or ways in which they organize and interact. They often do, but with an emphasis on the autonomy of the local church. Maybe just a little bit of assessment before we head on here. Positively, there is a place for the congregation's input. Maybe you remember last week we looked at Acts chapter 6. When we were talking about deacons, and when the apostles became so busy with the helping of the widows getting the bread, what did they do? I hear lots of whispers. Yes.
It was brought to the attention of the congregations that they needed men to preach the word and men to be deacons.
Yeah,
they
so they
established a deacon
oversight. Yeah, so they went to the congregation and asked them to bring forward some men among them to be able to be put in charge of this matter. And, that's a sign of the importance of the congregation and the congregation's input. So I do think there's a role for the congregation's input. And I also mentioned, I think, when the congregational model is at its best is when there's a pastor and a board of elders working together in leadership of the church. I'm not a fan of the pastor as CEO model. I'm not a fan of the deacons as equivalent of elders in other churches. I think the elder office is what we see here. We'll get into Presbyterian and talk about the emphasis on elder leadership in the church. On the congregational side, some negatives is that often too much power is vested in the congregations as members. Congregation members aren't all equally trained and able to make decisions on, say, doctrine of the church. But in a congregationalist model, essentially, the members as a whole are having to make decisions about the doctrinal stances of the church. And though I hope that congregational members will affirm right doctrine, you know, when there was an issue in doctrine and practice in Acts chapter 15, what did they do? They didn't call the congregation members to resolve the matter. They called the apostles and the elders to resolve the matter. And time and again, we do not see the kind of power vested in members as a whole, though there is an emphasis on the value of members and their participation in the church government. Maybe a way to think about it is when we get into the Presbyterian part, we'll talk about some of the places we see in the Bible of the elders and their decisions, and the decisions then of the elders are enforced by the congregation. So like in the Old Testament, when the elders found someone guilty of certain crimes, who would stone the person if it was worthy of stoning to death? Who would stone them? Who?
The congregation.
But notice it wasn't the congregation decided he should be stoned, and then the elders went and stoned him, which is maybe arguably the congregationalist model, right? The congregations decide what the elders are to do. But no, the elders decide that this man has fallen guilty, and therefore now the congregation is showing their submission to the elders' decision, but yet corporately applying the church discipline under the Old Covenant. And the same thing, we see something similar in like the book of 1 Corinthians, even when Paul passes judgment on the man who had committed incest, he says to expel the immoral brother. But in 1 and 2 Corinthians, you see references that talk about that this is something that's supposed to be enforced by the majority, by the congregation. I think congregationalist model kind of flips it around, puts it backwards. Secondly, the independent aspect of we just are all independent congregations, that we don't have any higher bodies to answer to. I think that that also is a failing of congregationalism. I think it's not a biblical model. When we get into Presbyterianism, we're going to look at Acts 15 a little bit and see that Acts 15 is one example of the connectedness of the body of Christ, that we're all not just here independent churches doing our own thing with very limited interaction, but that there is a connectedness that includes aspects of government and authority that we want to maintain in the larger body of Christ. Questions on congregationalism, my kind of positives and critiques? Judy. Absolutely. One of the problems with congregationalist model is, and this is now harmful for the pastor part, is when the congregation suddenly decides they don't like the pastor for something he did, it's very easy for the congregation to overnight just vote him out and he's out of a job, so to speak, and on the streets. at least in the Presbyterian model, if the pastor has really done something wrong, then you have to essentially, put him on charge and have the presbytery, the elders outside of just your local church, put him on trial and examine him. So he has protections from just the fleeing whims of the people. Like that's the problem when you look at different forms of political government. We're in a democratic republic, right? We have a democracy, but we vote in rulers, and that's, say, different than just a pure democracy where, like they had in Greece, where everybody just came and powerful speeches, and the people were swayed one moment to the next, and in our government, we say it's wiser to have a democratic republic where we as a people vote in leaders versus just always having the whim of the people from one moment to the next, because it can be very fleeting and changing and made of people that maybe aren't as familiar with the topics or issues and whatnot. So I think there's certainly a lack of protection for the pastor, but then you mentioned the other way too. It can be very easy to get off the right track when it's just the one man leading it. Then you suddenly, his hobby horses can suddenly become cultish very quickly, and you can think of any major cult, how it started so often with one man that was very inspirational that led the people down the wrong way. So, good. Other questions or reactions to the Congregationalist pros and cons? In addition, when I say pros and cons, of course, really we're asking what's the Bible have to say about it, but there's what's the Bible have to say about it, and then what are the practical ramifications of that, too? It's all related, so. All right, well, let's move into the Episcopal section. You could also, I think on this one I said Congregationalist or Independent. This one you could say Episcopal or Hierarchical. Hierarchical, right? Hierarchical is a structure of leadership where you've got the lowest level has to answer to the next level up, to the next level up, to the next level up. Most businesses have some idea of this, right? You've got the CEO, and then you've got maybe the VPs, and then you've got directors, and then you've got various kinds of middle management, and then you finally got the final guy at the bottom, and you have to go up the chain of who you answer to. The Episcopal model is a hierarchical model that's trying to run the church like that. Or think about it, even in monarchies, you have a king, but then you might have governors. And then under governors, you might have city magistrates. And the city magistrate might answer to the governor, and the governor answers to the king or the emperor. So it's the hierarchical model. Now, of course, in Episcopal models, they don't tend to call them king of the church. They tend to use language of, for example, you often see these offices we've mentioned in part. In the Catholic Church, you've got deacons, then you have priests, and then you have bishops. Familiar with the terms? Deacon, priest, and bishop are often the various levels of leadership within these sort of Episcopal setups. And so in the Catholic Church, it really is more something like this. You've got Pope at the top, and you've got... we'll put a bishop right here, and then a priest, and then you've got deacon. And they often have the language of archbishop, too. And so, often what it is you've got popes overall in the Catholic model, and at least in the Catholic Church, my understanding is they have bishops are kind of like the regional people in charge. But in big enough regions, they have an archbishop who basically manages the bishops of that area. So maybe you've heard of someone help me out. Is that pronounced here right?
Diocese,
thank you. I have trouble with that word. And you have the archdiocese, which is kind of like the bigger group of that smaller group. And so those are the regional things. So you maybe it's something like if this is the church, you've got these dioceses. You've got a bunch of them, and then maybe archdiocese might cover a bigger area. And within dioceses, you've got parishes. These are their local local churches, right? And so the priests will tend to be, you know, the leader of a parish. The bishop will be tend to be of the diocese, and the archbishops will be of the archdiocese. And then you got, of course, at the top, the pope. This is a simplification. If you look in the Catholic hierarchy, it can get pretty complex. And then deacons, interestingly, they have lay deacons, which, when I say lay deacon, that's an oxymoron. Lay refers to non-ordained. But you've got, like, non-professional deacons, people that have a full-time job that also serve as an ordained deacon, but not as we use deacon, really. We use a deacon as mercy ministry. Theirs is really, they really do a lot of the priestly functions, too. But then you also have deacon as stepping stone to become priest. So past priest in training can start as, you start as a deacon and then move your way up. And the idea is you could potentially keep moving your way up, just like you might climb the corporate ladder, you might climb the church government ladder. Versus like in our situation, we'll talk about, you know, we see deacon and elder and minister as different callings. You know, sometimes someone does start as a deacon and later becomes an elder, but it's not like one's better than the other, or like, you know, you become a deacon so you can hopefully later become an elder. It's not that thinking. It's how you're gifted and how God's using you. Versus here, deacon tends to be kind of a training ground for priest and, you know, potentially moving your way up the ladder. But the bottom line is that it's a hierarchy. Now, part of the reasoning or the rationale for the hierarchy goes into a discussion we had last week. I'm going to erase this. Is that okay? If you guys remember last week, I told you that the word for elder. You guys remember what I told you the word for elder was? Presbyter. And what was the word for overseer in the New Testament? Bishop. Now, I think bishop is the Latin word. The Greek word is actually episkopos. Do you see episkopos? and presbyter. Bishop, episkopos, same idea. This is, like I said, what we translate as elder. This is what we translate as overseer. The contention of this system is that these are two different offices. This essentially is where they get the priest idea, and this is where they get the bishop idea. And they say the bishop is the higher office than the presbyter office. Now, that sounds nice and all. The problem I see with it, as well as others, is when you look in the New Testament, it seems that at different places, these two terms are used as synonyms. What's a synonym? They're the same thing, yeah. So, for example, flip over to Titus 1, 5 through 7. Titus. Okay, who's got that for me? Jennifer.
Titus what?
1, 5 through 7.
The reason I left you in Crete was that you might straighten out what was left unfinished and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. An elder must be blameless, the husband of but one wife, the man whose children believe and are not open to charge of being wild and disobedient. Since an overseer is entrusted with God's work, he must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain.
As you keep on reading, give some more qualifications for the office of elder. But did you notice in verse 5, elder is mentioned? What's the reference in verse 7 about this description that they're giving? Bishop, or overseer, depending on your translation. This is one of a few places where in the New Testament it seems that these are the same thing, different words to talk about the same office. Presbyter, Episcopus, same thing. Interesting, it's sometimes still a point of debate, even in Presbyterian circles. Some have suggested that this is what we consider as the elder, and this is what we consider as the minister. You know, I mentioned the three office view last week, deacon, elder, and minister. As much as I like that line of thinking, I still go back to the point that in the New Testament, it seems that these are treated as synonyms, as equated, and to make them into a hierarchy as in here does not seem to be in keeping with it. I don't have all the details, but I think it was the previous pope wrote an article or something where he even acknowledged that the New Testament used them in a synonymous way. Now, here's where there's a sort of interesting historical note. I think we're wise to look at the early church and see how the earliest church was doing things, and that often can help us. And I tend to be very appreciative and think that should help inform us. What's interesting when you look at the earliest records we have of the church where it starts talking about government, it seems very quickly they ended up in an episcopal setting. And so, you know, we take a pause when we think of that and we remember sola scriptura. You know, what's the real rule for our faith and practice? It is the Bible. And as much as I think we rightly look at what they did in the early church and can learn a lot from them, the earliest records are still, you know, the farther you go back, you have fewer documents. As you go along, you get more and more documents, you know, just in terms of preserving documents. That's tend to be what happens. And the earliest references are not, here's how to run your church government. So even the earliest references aren't absolutely clear that it is episcopal, but it does seem that very quickly, as more and more was mentioned, that very quickly you had a situation where there was a bishop that was running elders that were following. But it's still, as you go back, it's a little murky. But what does the New Testament say? Titus, I think, is one example. There are others that seem to connect to the two and to see them as synonyms. You could imagine, though, why maybe in the early church, quickly it turned into something hierarchical. Any ideas why? Just speculating why that might have been?
That was
kind of
culture.
That was a culture, right? I mean, that's how governments worked. Rome, how were they ran? Emperor, hierarchical though, right? Not just emperor, but emperors and governors, and, you know, it was a hierarchy. And it's easy to fall into this. And even then, like, at our session meetings, we have our elders, and we have someone moderate the session meeting, the elder meeting. That usually is the pastor. And you can imagine, maybe some of that was what was started out. And then people start seeing that, and the next thing you know, went from moderator to you know, bishop or pope or in charge. In other words, it's easy to kind of move suddenly, quickly, a few generations into a wrong extreme. I think of even in Joshua, you know, at the end of Joshua, the book of Joshua, and into the first chapter of Judges, things seem to be going so well under Joshua's leadership. And the very next generation, as Joshua leaves him, Joshua says, you know, decide for yourself today who you're going to follow. He says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And the very next generation, did they do that? No, they went so far off so quickly. So very possible that's what began to happen quickly in the church government, that people who labored in the word as pastors full time versus lay elders. When I say that, I mean, you know, people who had regular jobs but were the ordained elders, they maybe quickly became understood as under the pastor model, and I don't think that's biblical, but I could appreciate how maybe it happened. What do you guys think? Any positives about this model?
Well, I was just thinking that back then, you know, you got these churches arranged around the Mediterranean basin, and Mm. cases, they were connected all the way around North Africa, so, you know, maybe send one guy from each region to a synod or a council. Maybe that's better than sending all the elders of the church.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe they fall into it for that reason too.
Absolutely. But you also bring out a strength of this over the Congregationalist model. The Congregationalist model, we said, emphasized the autonomy of the local church. What's nice about this model is they recognize the connectedness of the broader church, right? That there isn't just a bunch of independent churches all by themselves. But even back then, as Walt was saying, when they didn't have internet, they didn't have printing press, they didn't have telephones, they found a way to be connected. And I think that's an important thing for us to emphasize, that though there may be things we don't like about this model, I appreciate the fact that they see the church is supposed to be beyond just independent bodies, but that we are a church, right? We are connected, we are united, and the idea that we'll talk about in a Presbyterian is that there should be some recourse to appeal to a body of judges even beyond your local church, like they do in Acts 15, to seek recourse and help beyond just your own local church. I think of the hierarchy that is good in here. We do see a sense of hierarchy in the Presbyterian model. The difference is the hierarchy is rooted in groups of leaders called elders, versus here the hierarchy is rooted in a person, right? A single person. Now, we mentioned, I think it was last week, Matthew chapter 18, on that passage often used about church discipline, and when you get in a conflict, what do? You go to the brother, and what? You try to be reconciled. And if that doesn't work, what do? Bring one or two witnesses. And if that doesn't work, what do? Bring it to the church, and by extension, we would say, you know, to the elders. And we often stop right there, but if you keep reading, it talks about the power of the church, and it says, where two or more are gathered in my name, with you. And that often gets misapplied to worship. I think there's an extended application, but the most immediate context is in that context of a judicial decision in the midst of a conflict in members. And the encouragement is not when the Pope is gathered, not when the Archbishop is gathered, not when one is gathered, but when two or more are gathered. And that's, I think, the problem in the hierarchy of the Episcopal model, is that it's often gathered in a single person. Now, I can appreciate why they might have ended up here. There are cases in the Bible of a man at the top. I think of Moses. Moses appointed hierarchical judges, and he was the guy at the top to answer the really tough cases. The judges often function that way in the Old Testament, but then it ultimately came into the hierarchy of the monarchy, and that was the king who was at the top then. So again, who's the king in the church? It's not the Pope. It's Christ. And the few examples in the Old Testament of someone at the top is a very special work of the Holy Spirit at that time, ultimately leading for Christ as king through the Davidic monarchy and promises. We have that. We don't then institute single-man hierarchy throughout the rest. Time and again, you look instead, what we're going to see here is elders ruling in the church. So, questions on Episcopal before we head into Presbyterian? There's other denominations besides just Rome that does this. The Anglican Church, for example, is also in America known as the Episcopalian Church, right? It's the same idea. Some Lutheran branches have an Episcopalian model. Communist Church in China is not really connected to Rome, even though they claim to be... I'm sorry, did I say Communist Church? Catholic. Oops. Maybe I said it right the first time. The Catholic Church in China is not really connected to the Pope, so they have their own thing, which is they all have some sort of top archbishop guy that runs the whole thing. So I think in the English Church, I think it's Archbishop of Canterbury, I think, is the one who's in charge, something like that. So anyways, Moving on to Presbyterian. Presbyterian. Essentially, this is saying Presbyterian comes from the word elder, that elders rule at multiple levels. So there is a connectedness outside of the local church, but the elders are ultimately, a plurality of elders are ultimately ruling. It's common to see several levels here. On the local church level, you have what's called a session, or in some circles it's called a consistory. And then groups of churches, regions of churches, are formed into what's called a presbytery, which is like a, basically regional. And that's also sometimes called classis. And then the overall, all the churches, all the presbyteries, is often referred to as a general assembly, or sometimes referred to as synod, depending on the various traditions that implemented this. They use different language. So, like our Dutch Reformed brethren in the United Reformed Churches use language of consistory, classis, and synod. I think that's what they use in the RCUS, which is German influenced. In Presbyterian, like from Scotland and Westminster Abbey sort, you know, they tended to adopt language of session, presbytery, and general assembly. Largely speaking, they're synonymous terms, but like any distinct denomination, there will be some minor differences. Essentially, each level is ruled by elders, and it tends to be something like this. A church has a board of elders, known as a session, and a church will send delegates or some of their elders to the presbytery level, however often the presbytery level meets, to handle presbytery-wide issues. And the same thing, the presbytery will send delegates of elders to the General Assembly. And General Assembly in our denomination meets once a year. Presbyteries meet as often as they want. Ours tends to meet twice a year, maybe a little bit more if special needs come up. And of course, on our church level, our session meets once a month, but we could meet as much as we wanted to. So these are, in some sense, a hierarchy, though not always, that's not always the language preferred to be used by every group that practices this. In our denomination, we call these higher assemblies. The URC, for example, calls these broader assemblies. They use the term, we'll talk about it in a moment. There is a small difference in the idea of calling it that different language. But the point is that every level, it is elder ran. And when I say elder ran, I'm including the ministers in there, elders and ministers. And each of these have their unique responsibilities. So that's why we have these broader groups or higher groups, is to do unique jobs. At the local session level, the local church level, the elders' focus there is to shepherd the people, shepherd the members, to order the worship, to organize and administer what's happening in that particular congregation. That includes things like examining new elders and new deacons, and ordaining new elders and new deacons. Actually, not in our denomination, though, not ministers. The ministers' examination happens on the presbytery level. So on the presbytery level, some of the things that they do is, as I mentioned, examine and ordain ministers. They will coordinate local church planting efforts in the region that they're covering. They will facilitate things like regional conferences that can be a blessing to all the churches in their area. They also handle judicial appeals from the session, from the elders. So remember, elders have a judicial component. They often serve as judges in the church courts. So if you have a conflict with another brother, and it ultimately comes before the elders, and they decide, and you're not happy with their decision, you can appeal it to the presbytery and have elders outside of our local church examine that and address your appeal. On the General Assembly level, they tend to handle theological issues that affect all the denomination, all the church as a large. You know, you think of like in the Acts 15 example, when there was a question about Jews and Gentiles relating and whether Gentiles who become Christian need to be circumcised. They formed a council that decided a theological issue and then sent that out for the churches for observance. And so that's a very common action of the General Assembly. They also coordinate the foreign mission work for the most part. You know, that makes sense. Foreign missions is not in the bounds of either of these two, so they tend to take the lead on that. They will take church planting lead when, especially, it's not in an area covered by either of these areas. Maybe it's some distant area that we haven't really reached yet in America that we want to do church planting with. They'll step up on that. And they also do things that help the church as a whole, like they do the New Horizons magazine that we have, things like that. Might have a national conference on a subject. And they will also handle the judicial appeals from the presbytery. So if the presbytery has a judicial case, it can be appealed to the General Assembly. There is an autonomy of sorts at each level. There's also a sense of connectedness, so that what happens, you know, in one presbytery on the other side of the coast is still something the OPC did. And we should be concerned if they did something that we didn't agree with, right? We're connected. And so that's important to recognize. At the same time, you know, presbytery is not going to just go to the local churches and get in the middle of their business just to do so, right? There is a sense of each of these are legitimate aspects of the church government and have certain responsibilities that they should be involved in. And there is congregational input on this. Our officers, by example, are nominated by the congregation. The sessions will examine elders and deacons, and if they concur with their fitness biblically for the office, then they put them before the congregation to a vote to approve one way or the other to have them serve as an elder or deacon in the local congregation. It's an example where the congregation is involved in the process. Congregations also call a pastor, and when the ordination process happens, they affirm that call as well. So there is an involvement of the congregation. I think it's fitting biblically with what we see the congregation doing in the Bible, but at the same time emphasizing the importance of elders ruling at these various levels. Questions? Mary?
Are there any denominations besides Presbyterians that use that?
So usually what you see this is referred to as either the Presbyterian or the Reformed form of government. Presbyterian is more linguistically descriptive. Reformed is more of a general thing. But there are lots of Presbyterian denominations and lots of Reformed denominations that use this type of government. So even if we don't agree on a lot of theology, so like the mainline Presbyterian Church of the United States of America, who we have so many disagreements with on their doctrine, their government is organized similar to this. The United Reformed Church does not have the word Presbyterian in their name. This is their form of government. The Reformed Church U.S., that's their form of government. So yes, there are many. Yes. Last week, Marlon asked me a very insightful question. He said, when the URC, United Reformed Church, split off from the CRC, they formed their government, and they called it specifically a federation. A federation. And they said they wanted to emphasize the autonomy of the local church. And Marlon's good question was, isn't that what you said Congregationalist was? And I had to point out, I said I'd look into it more too, but there is some sense of sounding similar, right? And there is, if you read over the URC's descriptions, they do have a greater emphasis on the autonomy of each local church. That being said, if you look at the URC, a lot of you guys know the URC, they're one of our sister denominations. They still, when you look at their government, they have a lot more in common with this model than this model, and I think it's still accurate to put them in this category. For example, the URC, these guys are the ones who examine the ministers, the presbytery level. They do call these broader assemblies, not higher ones, but if you don't agree with the decision of the assembly can ultimately ask you to leave then the federation if you're not going to heed what the decision was, versus if you look at the Southern Baptist Convention, that usually doesn't happen. You could usually be in the Southern Baptist Convention even if you don't agree with everything that the convention has said one way or the other. They also have judicial appeals in the URC. You can have a case on this level that gets appealed up the chain of command. It's not chain of command, but up the courts. So in the grand scheme of it, there's a lot more in common. And I would say it's still largely understood a Presbyterian model, even though there's a small emphasis in the language of the autonomy of the local church. They certainly would fall in the Presbyterian model, not the Congregationalist model. Walt.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've been in the URC, and I didn't notice the difference, except that the classes will not record the minutes thoroughly. You can't access them through a lay person. But in the OBC, you can read, well, at least I have in the past, I've read everything you've said according to the Presbyterian meeting. Whereas in the URC, the clerk of the classes
guards the minutes, or gotcha. Yeah, I don't know about that. I'll take your word for that. I know that in our denomination, yeah, each level keeps their minutes and they're publicly available.
What tends to happen when a congregation start, or a church goes liberal, like in the CRC or PCUSA, is that there'll be a bunch of churches that are liberal that start ganging up on conservative churches, which are usually in the minority, and controlling what the flow of what is said in General Assembly and what's allowed to be brought to the floor. So I think that's probably the language you're hearing in the autonomy of the local church. It's more addressing that than saying we want to be congregationalists.
Exactly. I think that's exactly the reason, because think about it, if you're in the URC, or you were in the CRC before, you split off to become part of the URC, the denomination you're in, you believe has liberal trends, and they say you are not submitting if you break away. This new model says that they can break away in peace because the local church has the decision to decide if they ought to still be part of this body that's holding something that's erroneous. And so it's written into their congregation in a way that, you know, gives them more freedom in light of a potential denomination gone astray. So I think that is exactly the concern that's mentioned there. Good. Well, we are out of time. What we're going to do next week is, at the start, we're going to give you some passages that briefly actually point to Presbyterian rule. Because I've told you all this, but we actually haven't looked at any Bible passages that show elders ruling at various levels. And so I'm going to look at some passages so you don't just know that, yeah, this sounds better, but hopefully that you see it, it's biblical. Now, we did look at passages last week, and we touched on a few today, but we're going to get into more next week as well. And then we're going to move on to the next part in our Doctrine of the Church class. Let's go ahead and close in prayer.